stores, one of which happened to be owned by my store's landlord, P.K. Holmes. That may or may not have had something to do with the trouble which was going to come soon, but we didn't think anything about it. I drew up a plan, bought a sign, bought new fixtures from a company up in Nebraska, and bought the merchandise, dresses, pants, shirts, jackets, whatever I thought I could sell. The fixtures arrived on Wednesday by train, and Charlie Baum, who was supposed to be supervising my merchandising for Butler Brothers, offered to help me put everything together. He was the most efficient store layer-outer I've ever known. We went over to the railroad tracks and unloaded the fixtures, put them together, laid out the store, put the merchandise together, and opened 6 days later on Monday. We called it the Eagle Store. So now we had two stores on Front Street in Newport. I would run up and down the alley with merchandise. If it didn't sell in one store, I would try it in the other. I guess they competed with each other, but not much. By now, the Ben Franklin was doing really well. The Eagle never made much money, but I figured I'd rather have a small profit than have my competitor over there in a big store. I had to hire my first assistant manager to help out in the Ben Franklin while I was running back and forth, and my brother Bud had come home from the war and was working with me, too. Bud Walton. That Newport store was really the beginning of where Walmart is today. We did everything. We would wash windows, sweep floors, trim windows. We did all the stockroom work, check the freight in. Everything it took to run a store. We had to keep expenses to a minimum. That's where it started years ago. Our money was made by controlling expenses. That, and Sam always being ingenious. He never stopped trying to do something different. One thing, though, I never forgave him for making me clean out that damned ice cream machine. He knew I'd hated milk and dairy products ever since we were kids. He used to squirt me when he milked the cows. I always thought he gave me that job because he knew I didn't like milk. He still laughs about it. We couldn't have felt better about our situation down there. Helen and I both have the kinds of personalities that make us want to participate in community life, and we had become deeply involved. We had joined the Presbyterian Church there, and even though I was a Methodist, it worked out real well. Just as Helen and I were raised in the church, we felt that our kids would benefit from a church upbringing. Church is an important part of society, especially in small towns. Whether it's the contacts and associations you make, or the contributions you might make toward helping other folks, it all sort of ties in together. Helen was very active in her church work, which she still is today, and in PEO, an international women's organization. Our four children had come along by now, and Helen really loved Newport. I was a member of the church's board of deacons, was active in the Rotary Club, and had become president of the Chamber of Commerce as well as head of its industrial committee. I was pretty much involved in everything around town. It so happened that on the other side of our store, also on Front Street, was a J.C. Penney. We didn't compete much, and I was friendly with the manager. So one day, this dapper supervisor from New York named Blake came to town to audit that store and got to chatting with the manager. "Say," the manager told Blake, "we've got an ex-Penny man right here in Newport. He came in a few years ago and really made a big success of it. He doubled sales in his Ben Franklin. He's got two stores, and he's the president of the Chamber of Commerce." And when the manager told him it was Sam Walton, old Blake almost fell over. "It can't be the same one I knew in Des Moines," he said. "That fellow couldn't have amounted to anything." He came next door, and we both had a big laugh about it when he saw that I really was that kid who couldn't write so you could read it. By now, my 5 years in Newport were about up, and I had met my goal. That little Ben Franklin store was doing $250,000 in sales a year, and turning $30,000 to $40,000 a year in profit. It was the number one Ben Franklin store for sales or profit, not only in Arkansas, but in the whole six-state region. It was the largest variety store of any sort in Arkansas, and I don't believe there was a bigger one in the three or four neighboring states. Every crazy thing we tried hadn't turned out as well as the ice cream machine, of course, but we hadn't made any mistakes we couldn't correct quickly. None so big that they threatened the business. Except it turned out for one little legal error we made right at the beginning. In all my excitement at becoming a Sam Walton merchant, I had neglected to include a clause in my lease which gave me an option to renew after the first 5 years. And our success, it turned out, had attracted a lot of attention. My landlord, the department store owner, was so impressed with our Ben Franklin's success that he decided not to renew our lease at any price, knowing full well that we had nowhere else in town to move the store. He did offer to buy the franchise, fixtures, and inventory at a fair price. He wanted to give the store to his son. I had no alternative but to give it up, but I sold the Eagle store lease to Sterling so that John Dunham, my worthy competitor and mentor, could finally have that expansion he'd wanted. It was the low point of my business life. I felt sick to my stomach. I couldn't believe it was happening to me. It really was like a nightmare. I had built the best variety store in the whole region and worked hard in the community, done everything right, and now I was being kicked out of town. It didn't seem fair. I blamed myself for ever getting suckered into such an awful lease, and I was furious at the landlord. Helen, just settling in with a brand new family of four, was heartsick at the prospect of leaving Newport. But that's what we were going to do. I've never been one to dwell on reverses, and I didn't do so then. It's not just a corny saying that you can make a positive out of most any negative if you work at it hard enough. I've always thought of problems as challenges, and this one wasn't any different. I don't know if that experience changed me or not. I know I read my leases a lot more carefully after that, and maybe I became a little more wary of just how tough the world can be. Also, it may have been about then that I began encouraging our oldest boy, 6-year-old Rob, to become a lawyer. But I didn't dwell on my disappointment. The challenge at hand was simple enough to figure out. I had to pick myself up and get on with it. Do it all over again, only even better this time. Helen and I started looking for a new town. Chapter 3. Bouncing Back. A quote from Helen Walton. When we left Newport, it was a thriving cotton town, and I hated to leave. We had built a life there, and it was so disturbing to have to walk away from it. I've said that time and time again. I still have good friends there from those days. I came out of that Newport experience with my pride a little damaged, but I had made money on the sale of the Ben Franklin, more than $50,000. The whole thing was probably a blessing. I had a chance for a brand new start, and this time I knew what I was doing. Now, at the age of 32, I was a full-fledged merchant. All I needed was a store. Helen and the kids and I started driving around in the spring of 1950, hunting in earnest for one, and Northwest Arkansas appealed to us for several reasons. First, for Helen, it was a whole lot closer to her folks in Claremore than Newport had been. And it was good for me because I wanted to get closer to good quail hunting. And with Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, and Missouri all coming together right there, it gave me easy access to 4 quail seasons in 4 states. We tried to buy a store in Siloam Springs on the Oklahoma border, but we couldn't come to terms with the owner, Jim Dodson, who later became a friend of ours. So one day, Helen's father and I drove into Bentonville and had a look around the square. It was the smallest of the towns we considered, and it already had 3 variety stores, when 1 would have been enough. Still, I love competition, and it just struck me as the right place to prove I could do it all over again. We found an old store willing to sell, Harrison's Variety Store, but we needed to double its size, and to do that we had to get a 99-year lease on the barbershop next door. No more 5-year leases for me. These 2 old widows from Kansas City who owned it wouldn't budge, and frankly, if Helen's father hadn't gone up there, unbeknownst to me, and negotiated a deal, I'm not sure where the Waltons would have ended up. Helen Walton. Bentonville really was just a sad-looking country town, even though it had a railroad track to it. It was mostly known for apples, but at the time chickens were beginning to come on. I remember I couldn't believe this was where we were going to live. It only had 3,000 people compared to Newport, which was a thriving cotton and railroad town of 7,000 people. The store was a small old country town store with cans of lace, boxes of hats, sewing patterns, everything you can imagine just stored around everywhere. But I knew right after we got there that it was going to work out. Now I had a store to run again, and even though it didn't do but $32,000 the year before I bought it, compared to $250,000 at Newport, it didn't matter that much because I had big plans. We tore the wall out between the barbershop and the old store, put in brand-new fluorescent fixtures instead of the few low-watt bulbs they had hanging from the ceiling, and basically built a new store in there. It was a huge store for Bentonville at the time, 50 feet by 80 feet, or 4,000 square feet. Charlie Baum of Ben Franklin came to my rescue again. This time he helped me break down all those fixtures he had helped me put up in my old Eagle store. We loaded them onto a big truck, which I drove over to Bentonville from Newport. We had to get on an old dirt road to bypass a weigh station over at Rogers, because I knew our load was illegal several different ways. Bouncing on that old road tore up half the fixtures. Anyway, Charlie and I installed them again. Around this time, I read an article about these 2 Ben Franklin stores up in Minnesota that had gone to self-service, a brand-new concept at the time. I rode the bus all night long to 2 little towns up there, Pipestone and Worthington. They had shelves on the side and 2 island counters all the way back. No clerks with cash registers around the store, just checkout registers up front. I liked it, so I did that too. Charlie Baum. As soon as Sam moved the store from Newport to Bentonville, he had a nice big sale, and we put barrels full of stuff all around the floor. Those elderly ladies would come in and bend way down over into those barrels. I'll never forget this. Sam takes a look, frowns, and says, "One thing we gotta do, Charlie, we gotta be real strong in lingerie." Times had been hard, and some of those underthings were pretty ragged. So when Charlie and I laid out that store in Bentonville, it became only the 3rd self-service variety store in the whole country, and the 1st in our 8-state area. Maybe nobody here knew it, but it was a big deal. We've got our first ad from the July 29, 1950 Benton County Democrat on display today down at our Walmart Visitors Center. It's for the grand remodeling sale of Walton's Five and Dime, promising a whole bunch of good stuff. Free balloons for the kids, 12 clothespins for 9 cents, iced tea glasses for 10 cents apiece. The folks turned out, and they kept coming. Although we called it Walton's Five and Dime, it was a Ben Franklin franchise, and that store took off just like Newport had, and turned into a good business right away. It really was an A1 store for these parts back then. Inez Threet. Clerk, Walton's Five and Dime, Bentonville. I guess Mr. Walton just had a personality that drew people in. He would yell at you from a block away, you know. He would just yell at everybody he saw. And that's the reason so many liked him and did business in the store. It was like he brought in business by his being so friendly. He was always thinking up new things to try in the store. I remember one time he made a trip to New York, and he came back a few days later and said, "Come here. I want to show you something. This is going to be the item of the year." I went over and looked at a bin full of, I think they called them Zori sandals. They call them thongs now. And I just laughed and said, "No way will those things sell. They'll just blister your toes." Well, he took them and tied them together in pairs and dumped them all on a table at the end of an aisle for 19 cents a pair. And they just sold like you wouldn't believe. I have never seen an item sell as fast, one after another, just piles of them. Everybody in town had a pair. Right away, I started looking around for store opportunities in other towns. Maybe it was just my itch to do more business, and maybe, too, I didn't want all my eggs in one basket again. By 1952, I had driven down to Fayetteville and found an old grocery store that Kroger was abandoning because it was falling apart. It was right on the square, only 18 feet wide and 150 feet deep. Our main competitor was a Woolworths on one side of the square and a Scott store on the other side of the square. So here we were challenging two popular stores with a little old 18-foot independent variety store. It wasn't a Ben Franklin franchise. We just called it Walton's Five and Dime, like the store in Bentonville. I remember sitting on the square right after I bought it, listening to a couple of the local codgers say, "Well, we'll give that guy 60 days, maybe 90. He won't be there long." But this store was ahead of its time, too. Self-service all the way, unlike the competition. This was the beginning of our way of operating for a long while to come. We were innovating, experimenting, and expanding. Somehow over the years, folks have gotten the impression that Walmart was something I'd dreamed up out of the blue as a middle-aged man, and that it was just this great idea that turned into an overnight success. It's true that I was 44 when we opened our first Walmart in 1962, but the store was totally an outgrowth of everything we'd been doing since Newport. Another case of me being unable to leave well enough alone, another experiment. And like most other overnight successes, it was about 20 years in the making. Of course, I needed somebody to run my new store, and I didn't have much money, so I did something I would do for the rest of my run in the retail business without any shame or embarrassment whatsoever. Nose around other people's stores searching for good talent. That's when I made my first real hire, the first manager, Willard Walker. Willard Walker, first manager, Walton's Five and Dime, Fayetteville. The first time I ever saw Sam Walton was when he and his brother-in-law, Nick Robson, dropped into a TGNY dime store I was managing in Tulsa. He visited with me for about an hour, asking a lot of questions, and left, and I never thought anything about it. Later on, he called me and said he was opening a new store in Fayetteville and wondered if I'd be interested in interviewing for the manager's job. I had to move myself over there, work half days for free until the store opened, and I remember sleeping on a cot in the storeroom. But he said I would get a percentage of the profits, and that appealed to me. When I went to quit TGNY, the vice president said, "Remember, Willard, a percentage of nothing is still nothing." But I went ahead and took the job. Sam was down there every day from the time we started until the time we left. He rolled up his sleeves and worked every day until we built that store from scratch. Sam would haul in all kinds of merchandise that he'd bought from those friends of his over in Tennessee, haul it in by station wagon. It worked real good. The first year that store was open, I believe, Bentonville did $95,000, and we did $90,000. Well, later on, when we had Walmarts and went public, I went out and borrowed what seemed like an awful lot of money at the time and bought stock with it. Bud and Sam came down the store one day, and Bud said, "Willard, I sure hope you know what you're doing." He told me I had more faith than he did. I always knew it was going to be successful. The philosophy made sense, and you couldn't help but believe in the man. In the years to come, that lure of partnership helped us attract a lot of good managers. But I don't believe we ever had one who bought more stock than Willard. And, of course, he feels pretty good about it today. I remember those days mostly as a time of always looking around for ideas and items that would make our stores stand out. Sometime in there, the hula hoop fad hit real big, and they were flooding the big city stores, but the genuine articles, which were made of plastic hose, were pricey and hard for us to get. Jim Dodson, the fellow who wouldn't sell me the Siloam Spring store, called me and said he knew a manufacturer who could make hose the same size as the hula hoops. He thought we should go in 50-50 and make our own hula hoops. We did. We made them up in his attic and sold a ton of them at his stores and mine. Every kid in Northwest Arkansas had to have one. Later, Jim ended up managing a Walmart for us up in Columbia, Missouri for about 15 years. Also at that time, I'd been buying all my fixtures from Ben Franklin. They were wooden standards, which was par for the course in those days, with wooden shelf brackets to hold the merchandise. Then I went somewhere to look at what Sterling Stores was doing. Most everything I've done I've copied from somebody else, and saw these all-metal fixtures. I met a guy named Gene Lauer here in Bentonville and persuaded him to build us some for the Fayetteville store, which became, I'm sure, the first variety store in the country to use 100% metal standards, like the ones you see in stores today. Gene built the fixtures for the first Walmart and stayed with us for 21 years before retiring a few years ago. Today he works here in Bentonville at the Walmart Visitors Center, which is sort of a museum located on the site of that first store. Charlie Kate, stock boy in Fayetteville store, now retired Walmart store manager. Sam used to come down to our Fayetteville store driving an old 53 Plymouth. He had that car so loaded up he barely had enough room to drive. And would you like to guess what he had in it? Ladies' panties. 3 for $1 and 4 for $1, and nylon hose. He would come in and take an end counter and say, "Now, Charlie, here's what you do. On this feature bin, you put 3 for $1 panties, and on this one, you put 4 for $1. And you put these nylons right in between the two of them, and then watch them sell." And they did, like crazy. While I was doing all this running around between Bentonville and Fayetteville and Tennessee and the Ben Franklin Regional Office in Kansas City, my brother Bud had borrowed some money and bought a Ben Franklin of his own up in the little town of Versailles, Missouri, population 2,000. He and I kept in touch, but we weren't really doing any business together, and he had started a family and was doing pretty well on his own. Well, one time when I was up in Kansas City, I heard about this big subdivision going up there, Ruskin Heights. In the middle of the subdivision would be a 100,000-square-foot shopping center. A whole new concept at that time. It was going to have an A&P store and a Ben Franklin store in the middle, a Crown drugstore on the end, and small shops in between. So I called Bud and told him to meet me up there right away. I said, "You want to gamble and go into this thing?" And he said, "Might as well." And we did. We borrowed all the money we could and went into that Ben Franklin 50-50. Bud Walton. In the early days of the variety store business out here, there were some conventions among competitors. Each chain more or less controlled its own state. Oklahoma was TGNY. Kansas was Alco. Texas was Mott's. Missouri was Mattingly. Nebraska was Hested's, Indiana was Danner's. They were locally based and developed, and they'd say, "Well, you don't cross my border, and I won't cross your border." Ben Franklin franchises were for little independent operators who wanted to fit a store or two somewhere in the cracks between those guys. Of course, Sam changed all that. Borders didn't mean much to my brother. He thought nothing of doing business in four states, all in one day. If I ever had any doubts about the potential of the business we were in, Ruskin Heights ended them. That thing took off like a house afire. The first year we made about $30,000 profits on sales of $250,000, which went up to $350,000 in no time. When I saw that shopping center catch on the way it did, I thought, man, this is the forerunner of many, many things to come. And I decided, with no money to amount to anything, to go into the shopping center development business myself back in Arkansas. I went down to Little Rock just on fire with the idea of being the pioneer shopping center developer there. I tried to get one real good corner, but a big Wheeler dealer with Sterling Stores bought it out from under me and put in what became the town's first shopping center, which featured a Sterling store and an Oklahoma Tire and Supply. I kept at it. I probably spent 2 years going around trying to sell people on the idea of shopping centers in Arkansas in the middle 50s, which was about 10 years too early. I finally got an option on one piece of property and talked Kroger and Woolworth into signing leases, based on us getting this one street paved. I started raising money for the pavement, but it got real complicated, and in the end, I decided I'd better take my whipping. So I backed out of the whole deal and went back to concentrating on the retail business. I probably lost $25,000, and that was at a time when Helen and I were counting every dollar. It was probably the biggest mistake of my business career. I did learn a heck of a lot about the real estate business from the experience, and maybe it paid off somewhere down the line, though I would rather have learned it some cheaper way. Incidentally, after I dropped my option on that last piece of land, a well-known young fellow named Jack Stevens, who had a whole lot more money than I did, went on to develop a successful shopping center that's still there. David Glass. Two things about Sam Walton distinguish him from almost everyone else I know. First, he gets up every day bound and determined to improve something. Second, he is less afraid of being wrong than anyone I've ever known. And once he sees he's wrong, he just shakes it off and heads in another direction. All during that real estate fiasco, I was, of course, still trying to run these variety stores, and everything was going along great until May 20th, 1957. I'll never forget the day. Bud called me from Versailles and said a tornado had hit the Ruskin store. "Oh, it probably shook up a little glass," I said. But later I got to worrying about it, and I couldn't get through to anybody up there, so I went on up to Kansas City to see for myself. I got there about 2 a.m. and saw that the whole shopping center was practically leveled. None of our people were seriously hurt, but the store was about gone. And even though the merchandise and the fixtures were insured, it was still a big blow to Bud and me. This was our best store, the one we were really excited about. It was there 1 minute and gone the next. We just rebuilt it and got back at it. By now, though, with all the places I had to visit, I was driving too much to have time for anything else, so I began to wonder if maybe flying wouldn't be the best way to go. Bud Walton. One day I got a call from Sam, and he said, "Meet me in Kansas City. I want to buy an airplane." Boy, it took me by such surprise. I always thought he was the world's worst driver, and even my father wouldn't ever let Sam drive him. I thought, he will kill himself the first year. So I did everything in the world to try and talk him out of that first airplane. He just said, "Whether you meet me or not, I'm going to go look at this airplane." And I did not go because I knew he would kill himself in that plane. He called me later and said he hadn't bought that particular plane, but he'd gone to Oklahoma City and bought this air coupe for $1,850, and I had to come see it. I'll never forget going out to the Bentonville Airport and seeing what he called an airplane. It had a washing machine motor in it, and it would put-put, and then miss a lick, then put-put again. It didn't even look like an airplane, and I wouldn't go near it for at least 2 years. But then we were putting some more stores in around Little Rock, and one day he says, "Let's go to Little Rock." I hadn't flown since the Navy in the Pacific, and I was always used to water. Here we were with Sam at the stick, going over all these trees and mountains. It was the longest trip I ever took. That was the start of the Walmart aviation era. In spite of what Bud says, I love that little two-seat plane because it would go 100 miles an hour if you didn't have the wind against you, and I could get to places in a straight line. And all the years and thousands of hours I've been flying, I've only had one engine failure, and it came in that air coupe. I was taking off from Fort Smith and was just over the river when an exhaust stack blew. It sounded like the end of the world. The motor hadn't quite quit, but I had to cut it off. For a minute there, I thought that might be it for me, but I was able to circle back and land with a dead engine. Once I took to the air, I caught store fever. We opened variety stores, many of them Ben Franklin franchises, in Little Rock, Springdale, and Siloam Springs, Arkansas. And we had a couple more in Neodosia and Coffeyville, Kansas. All these stores were organized as separate partnerships between Bud and me, along with other partners, including my dad, Helen's two brothers, Nick and Frank, and even the kids, who invested their paper route money. John Walton, second son of Sam and Helen. This is hard to believe, but between my paper route money and the money I made in the Army, both of which I invested in those stores, that investment is worth about $40 million today. Whatever money we made in one store, we'd put it in another new one and just keep on going. Also, from Willard Walker on, we would offer to bring the managers we hired in as limited partners. If you had, say, a $50,000 investment in a store, and the manager put in $1,000, he'd own 2%. Gary Reinboth. He would never let us buy more than $1,000 per store. I think $600 of it was a loan and $400 of it was four shares of privately owned stock at $100 a share. All he would guarantee was that he would pay us interest every year, which at that time was 4.5%. I remember one guy who ran a store would call and say, "Are you going to buy into store so-and-so?" And I'd say, "I think so." Later he would say, "I'm not going to loan it to Sam and let him expand on my money." Then I'd pick up the phone and call Mr. Walton and say, "So-and-so isn't going to buy his share of that store. Can I buy his share?" He'd say, "Sure." So I'd get a double share. That whole period, which scarcely gets any attention from most people studying us, was really very, very successful. In 15 years' time, we had become the largest independent variety store operator in the United States. But the business itself seemed a little limited. The volume was so little per store that it really didn't amount to that much. I mean, after 15 years in 1960, we were only doing $1.4 million in 15 stores. By now, you know me. I began looking around hard for whatever new idea would break us over into something with a little better payoff for all our efforts. Our first big clue came in St. Robert, Missouri, near Fort Leonard Wood, where we learned that by building larger stores, which we called family centers, we could do unheard-of amounts of business for variety stores over $2 million a year in sales per store, just unthinkable for small towns. The same thing proved true to a lesser degree in Berryville, Arkansas, and right here in Bentonville, too. I began to hear talk of the early discounters, companies like Ann and Hope, whose founder, Marty Chase, is generally considered the father of discounting. Spartans and Mammoth Mart and two guys from Harrison, and Zayer and Arlen's were all starting up in the Northeast, and I remembered that lesson I'd learned a long time ago in Newport with the panties selling in such huge volume when they were priced at a dollar instead of a dollar 20. So I started running all over the country, studying the concept from the mill stores in the East to California, where Saul Price started his Fed Mark in 1955. Then closer to home, Herb Gibson, a barber from over at Berryville, started his stores with a simple philosophy, buy it low, stack it high, sell it cheap. He sold it cheaper than anybody ever had before, and he sold more of it. He did it in Abilene, he did it in Amarillo, and he surrounded Dallas with stores. Then in 1959, he came to Northwest Arkansas with a franchisor named Howard's and did so well in Fort Smith that he branched out to the square in Fayetteville and started competing with our variety stores. We knew we had to act. He was the only one discounting out this way, and because I had made all those trips back east, I was probably one of the few out here who understood what he was up to. By then, I knew the discount idea was the future, but I was used to franchising, and I liked the mindset. I generally liked my experience with Ben Franklin, and I didn't want to get involved in having to build a company with all that support apparatus. So first, I went up to Butler Brothers in Chicago, armed with my usual yellow legal pad full of notes, and made a big pitch for them to back me in a discounting venture. I wanted them to be our wholesale arm, our merchandiser. If they had agreed, our family could have continued our fairly normal lifestyle. In those days, I wasn't as fully committed with my time to the business, and it wouldn't have been all that difficult to put together an organization with them. But they weren't interested. Then I approached Gibson, but he already had his franchisor, so we couldn't get together either. We really had only two choices left. Stay in the variety store business, which I knew was going to be hit hard by the discounting wave of the future, or open a discount store. Of course, I wasn't about to sit there and become a target. Now, right down the road from Bentonville sits Rogers, Arkansas, which was a good bit bigger town, but I could never operate there because Max Russell owned the Ben Franklin franchise. I tried to talk him into going in with me as a partner in building a big store there, but he wasn't interested. I went ahead and started building a store in Rogers. It was a big commitment on the family's part. We couldn't use Ben Franklin at all for that store, so I had made some arrangements with a distributor in Springfield, Missouri. Nobody wanted to gamble on that first Walmart. I think Bud put in 3%, and Don Whitaker, whom I had hired to manage the store from a TGNY store out in Abilene, Texas, put in 2%, and I had to put up 95% of the dollars. Helen had to sign all the notes along with me, and her statement allowed us to borrow more than I could have alone. We pledged houses and property, everything we had. But in those days, we were always borrowed to the hilt. We were about to go into the discount business for real now. And from the time those doggone Walmarts opened until almost today, it has been a little challenging. Bob Bogle, first manager, Walton's Five and Dime, Bentonville, now retired from Walmart. We were flying to Fort Smith in the spring of 1962, and Sam was piloting the plane over the Boston Mountains. It was that Tri-Pacer by then, not the original plane that we had made a lot of trips in. Sam pulled his card out of his pocket, on which he'd written down three or four names, and he handed it to me and asked me which one I liked best. They all had three or four words in the title, and I said, "Well, you know, Scotch as I am, I'd just keep the Walton name and make it a place to shop." I scribbled Walmart on the bottom of the card and said, "To begin with, there's not as many letters to buy." I had bought the letters that said Ben Franklin, and I knew how much it cost to put them up and to light them and repair the neon, so I said, "This is just seven letters." He didn't say anything, and I dropped the subject. A few days later, I went by to see when we could start setting the fixtures in the building, and I saw that our sign maker, Rayburn Jacobs, already had the WAL up there and was headed up the ladder with an M. You didn't have to be a genius to figure out what the name was going to be. I just smiled and went on. Something else about that sign that's worth mentioning. On one side of it, I had Rayburn put, "We sell for less," and on the other, "Satisfaction guaranteed." Two of the cornerstone philosophies that still guide the company. After years and years of studying the discount business and experimenting with it sort of half-heartedly, we were finally getting ready to jump in it whole hog. On July 2, 1962, we finally opened Walmart number 1, and not everybody was happy about it. Lee Smith, early Walmart associate. Because there was a Ben Franklin store in Rogers, run by somebody else, we really stirred up a hornet's nest when we opened that first store. I vividly remember opening day. Along with the crowds of shoppers, a group of officials from Ben Franklin in Chicago, all dressed in pinstriped suits, showed up. They marched in like a military delegation, and in the front of the store asked me, just as cold as they could be, "Where is Mr. Walton?" They marched on back to Sam's office without a word. They were back there about a half hour, and then they marched out without so much as a goodbye. A few minutes later, Sam came down and told Whitaker and me that they had issued an ultimatum. "Don't build any more of these Walmart stores." We knew he felt threatened because he had all those Ben Franklin franchises. But we also knew Sam Walton wasn't the kind of guy you issued ultimatums to. To tell the truth, though, that first Walmart in Rogers wasn't all that great. We did $1 million in a year, a lot more than most of our variety stores, which did $200,000 to $300,000 a year. But remember, St. Robert, up there in that army town, was doing $2 million in sales. Once we opened Rogers, we sat there and held our breath for 2 years. Then we put stores up in Springdale, a bigger town near Rogers, and Harrison, a smaller town. Here, of course, I have to let David Glass tell his now famous story about coming to Harrison to see what a Walmart was and being so horrified at the sight. David Glass. In those days, word was starting to get out that a guy named Sam Walton had some interesting retailing ideas. So I drove down from Springfield, where I was with Crank Drugs at the time, to see a Walmart opening. It was the worst retail store I had ever seen. Sam had brought a couple of trucks of watermelons in and stacked them on the sidewalk. He had a donkey ride out in the parking lot. It was about 115 degrees, and the watermelons began to pop, and the donkey began to do what donkeys do, and it all mixed together and ran all over the parking lot. And when he went inside the store, the mess just continued, having been tracked in all over the floor. He was a nice fellow, but I wrote him off. It was just terrible. I guess it really was about as bad as David describes it, but he just happened to hit it on its worst day. The store was only 12,000 square feet and had an 8-foot ceiling and a concrete floor with bare-boned wooden plank fixtures. Sterling had a huge variety store in downtown Harrison with tile on the floor, nice lights, really good fixtures, and good presentations. Ours was just barely put together. Highly promotional, truly ugly, heavy with merchandise. But for 20% less than the competition, we were trying to find out if customers in a town of 6,000 people would come to our kind of a barn and buy the same merchandise strictly because of price. The answer was yes. We found out they did, and they wanted it. Today we have a 90,000-square-foot store in Harrison. Down the road in Springdale, we were trying to learn something else. Would a really big, nice store work in a larger town? We opened a 35,000-square-foot Walmart there, and it quickly became our number one store in sales. Just to give you some idea of how the whole concept has changed over the years, we recently opened a gigantic 185,000-square-foot store in Springdale, and the store in Rogers today is 135,000 square feet compared to 18,000 for the original old number one. Maybe a lot of people saw the same things David Glass observed that day out there in Harrison, but I was feeling pretty good. After we got those first three stores up and running, I knew it would work. Walmart was off to a good start, and we saw lots of potential. But now Gibson's and other folks were beginning to look at the smaller towns and say, "Hey, maybe there's something out there that we ought to look into." We figured we'd better roll the stores out just as quickly as we could. Chapter 4. Swimming Upstream. A quote from Charlie Kate, store manager. From day one of Walmart, Mr. Walton made it clear that this wasn't just Ben Franklin with low prices on some items. He wanted real discounting. He said, "We want to discount everything we carry." When the other chains around us weren't discounting, he said, "We'll advertise that we sell for less, and we mean it." So whatever else we did, we always had to sell for less. If an item came in and everybody else in town was selling it for 25 cents, we'd go with 21 cents. As I said earlier, once we opened that Walmart in Springdale, I knew we were on to something. I knew in my bones it was going to work. But at the time, most folks, including my own brother Bud, were pretty skeptical of the whole concept. They thought Walmart was just another one of Sam Walton's crazy ideas. It was totally unproven at the time, but it was really what we'd been doing all along, experimenting, trying to do something different, educating ourselves as to what was going on in the retail industry and trying to stay ahead of those trends. This is a big contradiction in my makeup that I don't completely understand to this day. In many of my core values, things like church and family and civic leadership and even politics, I'm a pretty conservative guy. But for some reason in business, I have always been driven to buck the system, to innovate, to take things beyond where they've been. On the one hand, in the community, I really am an establishment kind of guy. On the other hand, in the marketplace, I've always been a maverick who enjoys shaking things up and creating a little anarchy. And sometimes the establishment has made me mad. The truth is, when those Butler Brothers folks turned down my discounting idea, I got a little angry, and maybe that helped me decide to swim upstream on my own. Don Soderquist, former president of Ben Franklin, now vice chairman and chief operating officer, Walmart. I first met Sam in 1964 when I was in charge of data processing at Ben Franklin, and he was our biggest franchise. He had already opened the Rogers Walmart, and he was up in Chicago trying to convince our officers to franchise his discount stores in small towns. They gave him a flat no. After the meeting, he came back to see me and moved right on to the subject of computers. He wanted to know all about how we were using them and how we were planning to use them. And he took everything I said down on this yellow legal pad. The next day was Saturday, and I went shopping, dressed in a pair of mangy cut-off jeans, at the Kmart near my house. I walked over into the apparel section and saw this guy talking to one of the clerks. I thought, geez, that looks like the guy I met yesterday. What the heck is he doing way out here? I strolled up behind him, and I could hear him asking this clerk, "Well, how frequently do you order?" "Uh-huh. How much do you order? And if you order on a Tuesday, when does the merchandise come in?" He's writing everything she says down in a little blue spiral notebook. Then Sam gets down on his hands and knees, and he's looking under this stack table, and he opens the sliding doors and says, "How do you know how much you've got under here when you're placing that order?" Finally, I said, "Sam Walton, is that you?" And he looked up from the floor and said, "Oh, Don, hi. What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm shopping. What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, this is just part of the educational process, that's all." Of course, he's still doing the same thing today, except he uses his little tape recorder. I guess everybody who knew I was going ahead with the discounting idea on my own really did think I'd completely lost my mind. I laugh now when I look back on Walmart's beginning. In 1962, the discount industry was fairly young and full of high-living, big-spending promoters driving around in Cadillacs. Guys like Herb Gibson, who had the world by the tail. But it had very few of what you'd call good operators. Until 1962, the year which turned out to be the big one for discounting. In that year, four companies that I know of started discount chains. S.S. Kresge, a big 800-store variety chain, opened a discount store in Garden City, Michigan, and called it Kmart. F.W. Woolworth, the granddaddy of them all, started its Woolco chain. Dayton Hudson, out of Minneapolis, opened its first Target store. And some independent down in Rogers, Arkansas, opened something called a Walmart. At the time, and for quite a while after that, I can guarantee you that hardly anybody noticed that last guy. Heck, within 5 years, Kmart had 250 stores to our 19, and sales of more than $800 million to our $9 million. Here's what makes me laugh today. It would have been absolutely impossible to convince anybody back then that in 30 years, most all of the early discounters would be gone. That three of these four new chains would be the biggest, best-run operators in the business. That the one to fold up would be Woolco. And that the biggest, most profitable one would be the one down in Arkansas. Sometimes even I have trouble believing it. I can tell you this, though. After a lifetime of swimming upstream, I am convinced that one of the real secrets to Walmart's phenomenal success has been that very tendency. Many of our best opportunities were created out of necessity, the things that we were forced to learn and do because we started out underfinanced and undercapitalized in these remote small communities, contributed mightily to the way we've grown as a company. Had we been capitalized, or had we been the offshoot of a large corporation the way I wanted to be, we might not ever have tried the Harrisons or the Rogers or the Springdales and all those other little towns we went into in the early days. It turned out that the first big lesson we learned was that there was much, much more business out there in small-town America than anybody, including me, had ever dreamed of. Clarence Lease, second manager, Walmart number 1. When we opened Walmart number 3 in Springdale, Sam wanted a red-hot price on antifreeze. So he got 2 or 3 truckloads of Prestone and priced it at $1 a gallon. Then he priced Crest toothpaste at 27 cents a tube. Well, we had people come from as far as Tulsa to buy toothpaste and antifreeze. The crowd was so big that the fire department made us open the doors for 5 minutes, then lock them until shoppers left. Sam grabbed a tackle box and started using it as a cash register, checking people out as fast as he could. We stuck with what we had learned in the variety store business about customer service and satisfaction guaranteed. But I have to admit that in those days we did not have anywhere near the emphasis on quality that we have today. What we were obsessed with was keeping our prices below everybody else's. Our dedication to that idea was total. Everybody worked like crazy to keep the expenses down. We tried to build decent buildings, but we had to keep the rent down. We never liked to pay more than $1 a square foot. Our stores really didn't look that good. They weren't professional at all. We opened one, store number 8, in Marlton, Arkansas, that was really a sight. We rented this old Coca-Cola bottling plant. It was all broken up into 5 rooms, and we bought some old fixtures from a failing Gibson's store for $3,000. We hung them by baling wire from the ceiling. We had clothes hanging in layers on conduit pipe all the way to the ceiling, and shelves wired into the walls. But this was really a small, small town. So number 8 was another experiment. We didn't have systems. We didn't have ordering programs. We didn't have a basic merchandise assortment. We certainly didn't have any sort of computers. In fact, when I look at it today, I realize that so much of what we did in the beginning was really poorly done. But we managed to sell our merchandise as low as we possibly could. And that kept us right side up for the first 10 years. That and consistently improving our sales in these smaller markets by building up our relationship with the customers. The idea was simple. When customers thought of Walmart, they should think of low prices and satisfaction guaranteed. They could be pretty sure they wouldn't find it cheaper anywhere else, and if they didn't like it, they could bring it back. Clarence Lees. Rogers had been open about a year, and everything was just piled up on the tables with no rhyme or reason whatsoever. Sam asked me to kind of group the stuff by category or department, and that's when we began our department system. The thing I remember most, though, was the way we priced goods. Merchandise would come in, and we would just lay it down on the floor and get out the invoice. Sam wouldn't let us hedge on the price at all. Say the list price was $1.98, but we had only paid 50 cents. Initially, I would say, well, it's originally $1.98, so why don't we sell it for $1.25? And he'd say, no, we paid 50 cents for it. Mark it up 30%, and that's it. No matter what you pay for it, if we get a great deal, pass it on to the customer. And, of course, that's what we did. It was a little frustrating there for a while, being out on our own. In addition to no basic merchandise assortment, we had no real replenishment system. We didn't even have inventory books like we had with the Ben Franklin stores, where if necessary you could simply look over what you needed and order it from Butler Brothers, then price it accordingly. We had no established distributors. No credit. Salesmen would just show up at our door, and we would try to get the best deals we could. Sometimes it was difficult getting the bigger companies, the Procter & Gamble's, Eastman Kodak's, whoever, to call on us at all, and when they did, they would dictate to us how much they would sell us and at what price. P&G gave a 2% discount if you paid within 10 days, and if you didn't, man, they took that discount right off. I don't mind saying that we were the victims of a good bit of arrogance from a lot of vendors in those days. They didn't need us, and they acted that way. I never could understand it. To me, it always seemed like a customer was a customer, and you ought to try to sell them what you could. The biggest challenge was buying health and beauty aids at low cost and staying stocked up on them because those items were really at the heart of almost every early discounter's strategy. I figured that out after I went into the first Gibson store. His whole concept was to buy direct at a lower cost than individual stores could buy, then charge $300 a month to run one of his franchises, and he would act as the store's buying agent. The basic discounter's idea was to attract customers into the store by pricing these items, toothpaste, mouthwash, headache remedies, soap, shampoo, right down at cost. Those were what the early discounters called your image items. That's what you pushed in your newspaper advertising, like the 27-cent Crest at Springdale. And you stacked it high in the stores to call attention to what a great deal it was. Word would get around that you had really low prices. Everything else in the store was priced low, too, but it had a 30% margin. Health and beauty aids were priced to give away. As far as building the company up, we simply had no time for it. We were too busy concentrating on day-to-day operations. I had moved my office from the Ben Franklin on the Bentonville Square to an old garage nearby, where I worked with three ladies who helped out with the bookkeeping. By the early 60s, we had 18 variety stores and a handful of Walmarts. For a time in there, we owned a mix of several different types of stores. We had variety stores under both the Ben Franklin and Walton names, as well as our Walmart discount stores. For years, while we were building Walmarts, we continued to run our various Ben Franklin and Walton variety stores. But we gradually phased them out, usually replacing them with Walmarts. We kept a little pigeonhole on the wall for the cash receipts and paperwork of each store. I had a blue binder ledger book for each store. When we added a store, we added a pigeonhole. I know we did that at least up to 20 stores. Then once a month, Wanda Wiseman and I would close those books, enter the merchandise, enter the sales, enter the cash, balance it, and close them. Nowadays, you hear a lot about fancy accounting methods like LIFO and FIFO. But back then, we were using the ESP method, which really sped things along when it came time to close those books. It's a pretty basic method. If you can't make your books balance, you take however much they're off by and enter it under the heading ESP, which stands for Error Someplace. Then we would come up with a profit and loss sheet, a P&L for each store, and get it out to that store manager as quickly as we could, something we still do today. If there was a problem, I would get with that manager immediately. But most of them owned a piece of their stores, so they were likely to be as concerned as I was. I had a big ledger sheet pasted together to make room for everything I wanted on it, probably 15 different columns for every store. It had columns for sales, expenses, net profit, markdowns, everything. Utilities, postage, insurance, taxes. I entered the numbers myself each month with a pen, which helped me remember them better. It became a habit with me, and I carried this ledger sheet in my pocket when I went to the stores, so everybody always knew exactly where they stood. For several years, the company was just me and the managers in the stores. Most of them came to us from variety stores, and they turned into the greatest bunch of discount merchants anybody ever saw. We all worked together, but each of them had lots of freedom to try all kinds of crazy things themselves. The closest thing we had to an operations manager was Don Whitaker, the guy I hired from TG&Y out in Abilene to be our first Walmart manager. After that, he became our first regional manager. Don had barely finished high school, if that, and he had terrible grammar. He threw people off sometimes because he only had one eye, and he looked at you sort of funny. But he was one of the finest people I've ever known in my life. Everybody called him Whitaker, and he was a hard-working, practical, smart fellow. He had a great big heart, but he was gruff, and he scared all the young folks to death. There was never any question that he was the boss, and when he wanted something done, believe me, it got done. I single him out here because Don Whitaker was very, very important in the early development of the company, establishing the philosophy of let's be out front, let's do it right, let's get it done now, and get on with it. Claude Harris, Walmart's first buyer. Sam is very sharp on being able to read people and their personalities and their integrity, and he didn't make any mistakes back there picking people, if I do say so myself. Really, back early, one bad manager could have pulled us under. When you're only making $8,000 or maybe $12,000 a year net in a store, it would have only taken one or two managers who were dishonest to lose the whole company. Sam would meet them in the stores where they worked and invite them down to look at his stores. You know, he's a very persuasive man. He could charm a bird out of a tree. And he and Helen would have you out to the house and serve ice cream. And they'd always ask if you and your family went to church. He was so good at evaluating and selecting these fellows. He wasn't just looking for store managers. I think he was selecting people he thought he could go forward with. He was progressive. He knew that he needed something, and he was looking for it. And he was getting it every step of the way. We found Claude over in Memphis running a Woolworth store. He was from Muskogee, Oklahoma, and about one-quarter Indian, and he had started with Woolworth out of high school. None of these fellows like Don or Claude had any college, and they didn't want me hiring any college men. They had the idea that college graduates wouldn't get down and scrub floors and wash windows. The classic training in those days was to put a two-wheeler, you know, a cart that you carry merchandise on, into a guy's hands within the first 30 minutes he came to work, and get him pushing freight out of the back room. They all came out of these variety stores with the same background and the same kind of philosophy and education. And we looked for the action-oriented, do-it-now-go type of folks. Claude had 4 or 5 kids and was probably making $12,000 a year, maybe $10,000. I hauled up in front of his soda fountain one day and started talking to him. I found out that he'd been able to save on his salary, and I usually felt that if a fellow could manage his own finances, he would be more successful managing one of our stores. We put him into our variety store on the east side of the square in Fayetteville, so he had to compete against our other store on the west side of the square, which was run by Charlie Kate and supervised by Charlie Baum at the time. That was a real test because nobody was more competitive than Charlie Baum. He would compete with a buzzsaw. But Claude was so skillful and nice that Charlie had to get along with him to some degree. Claude Harris. My store wasn't making much money, and we were starting to get competition from Gibson's, which also had a little store on the square down there. It was obvious that their discounting thing was working, and they were pulling everybody in with their health and beauty aids, HBA, we call it. So I thought, well, why don't I try that in my variety store? I changed the whole store around and got McKesson Robbins down in price and put in a bunch of over-the-counter drugs. It was the first discount department at our company, the health and beauty aids department at the east side of the square in Fayetteville. But I like to have lost my best friend over that one. Charlie Baum liked to have had a heart attack. He thought I was trying to undercut him. You got to understand that Charlie is one of the most competitive people who ever lived. He'll fight you tooth and toenail at bridge or anything. I was just trying to see where it might lead us. Anyway, Sam knew all about it, and he said, go ahead and try it. He would always try things like that. He was always open to suggestions, and that's one reason he's been such a success. He's still that way.